Good afternoon. It is 12:02, Monday, and finally, after a too prolonged an absence.
Sabbatical.
And, of course, the holidays as well. It's Wolfboro Police Chief Dean Rondo is with us.
And, woohoo!
Welcome back, man.
Hey, it's good to be back.
Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. You're looking great.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. The beard's coming in nice.
Oh, thank you very much. Yes. Yeah. You like it?
I do.
I've been getting compliments all over the place. Yeah, it's surprising.
Now, are you going to keep it, or is this
I think so. The big test was, ladies and gentlemen, I went down to Florida several weeks ago to help surprise my three granddaughters. Who are having a surprise Disneyland trip?
Oh, nice!
Disney World trip. Their dad, my son, is a major in the Army. He's at Fort Benning. He decided he was going to take the family down to Disney World. Of course, he's getting posted to Saudi Arabia to be an advisor to the Saudi Army. He's a major at Fort Benning, infantry officer, and so this was to help kind of break some of that, you know, bad news. And it worked, so I went down there to, Shelley and I, my wife and I went down there, and so the big test was, do the granddaughters like it? And they loved it. Yeah. They loved it, so.
What does Mrs. Rondo think of it?
It's growing on her.
That's a good one.
Yeah, that's what she said. I said, what do you think? She said, it's growing on me. I said, okay, fine.
While you're here, I've got a couple of things to talk about with you today.
Of course.
One of which, I've heard the term before, I don't know much about it, but I thought we'd explore it today, is verbal judo.
Oh, gerbil voodoo.
Or yeah.
That's what I call it.
Some kind of de-escalation tactic.
Yes, yeah.
Now, I mean, you hear about it a lot. I know some agencies probably train it, some probably don't. What do you think of it?
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah, we use it all the time. Yeah, I'm a big believer in it. Yeah,
tell us a little bit about it.
So, it's as I nicknamed it Gerbil Voodoo when I was at the police academy. Our police academy has been training it. I've been out of the academy now almost 26 years. So, we were getting it. We received the instruction, the training when I went through the academy. In 1996, so it's been around for a while, and they're still training it. They're still teaching it. It is a de-escalation technique that uses a lot of different things: logic, physical response to questions. The purpose of verbal judo is to de-escalate a situation, to calm somebody down, speaking in hushed tones and forcing the person to listen to you, so all works really well. In a situation where somebody is yelling and screaming, of course, if you speak really softly in a normal conversation, it just pisses people off, so you don't want to do that. But when someone's yelling and screaming, and they're having a difficult moment, if you speak in a somewhat softer tone, it forces them to listen to what you're saying, because they want to hear what you're saying. And if they're yelling and screaming or talking over you, they can't hear you. So it takes practice, and it's a skill. Like all skills, it needs to be practiced, or else it becomes perishable and you lose it. So you use logic to help defray the situation and to de-escalate the situation. And so, yeah, it's good. It works. I've used it many times.
Are there particular word tracks that you follow, or is it it's
basically all based on logic. So this is really an attempt to reason with somebody who at the moment is being clearly unreasonable.
Okay.
All right. So whatever whatever the issue is, you're in a difficult situation, confrontational situation, and you're trying to de-escalate that, you would use this technique to help them to see what the logical thing would be to do. Does that make sense?
It does.
Yeah. It's situation dependent.
Okay. So it's not a particular, it's not a way of saying things. It is a way of saying things as opposed to saying particular things.
Yeah, you're not, there's no magic list of words you're going to use here or phrases or anything else like that. No.
Okay. No. I didn't know if it was, cause I didn't know whether it was designed to not so much keep up the argument, but, you know, almost like spike strips where hopefully, you know, The tires will deflate slowly and everything will be safe.
Spike strips work.
Yeah. That I believe.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they work. We've used them several times. Yeah, they work.
I've always wondered when you throw them out there and the guy you're chasing hits them, mm-hmm. how does somebody else not hit them?
Because you when you deploy the tool, good question. When you deploy the tool, the asset, in the form of spike strips, they're attached to, you know, dummy cord. You have a cord, and you pull them back. That way, the pursuing police cars, if you will, don't hit them.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
Of course it does. So, getting back to your verbal judo,
yes,
yeah, this is all situation dependent. It could be something as simple as taking somebody into custody and getting them to calm down so they're not resisting arrest and da-da-da, you know. You're appealing, what you're trying to do is appeal to their logical cortex that helps them reason and make rational decisions. In order to get them to do that, they have to calm down.
Okay.
The adrenaline has to stop flowing.
Out of curiosity, and this is kind of where I wanted the main discussion to go today, what... Roughly, I mean, I'm sure you don't have the stat right off the top of your head, but are there at least a significant number of people that you guys arrest that have, shall we say, mental issues?
Ooh.
Now, I realize that Wolfboro is a little bit different from, say, Nashua.
Actually, no, it's not. I would make a statement. Okay, so really good question. So the short answer is no. Because we don't necessarily collect data on the mental health of everybody we arrest, so therefore I can't give an accurate assessment. However, but there's more. But wait, there's more. Relative to Wolfboro being like Nashua or different from Nashua, the answer is yes and no. I would argue, and I will argue that Wolfboro is similar to Nashua. Per capita of the population for everything we deal with. All right, so what does that mean? That means that per capita of our population, if you looked at our crime stats, you would find, if you broke it down percentage by population density, they're going to be about the same.
Oh.
Yeah. So, yeah, and I would say the same thing. You know, you could compare, if you will, if you want to, you could look at Wolfboro versus New York City, and you would find similar statistics. Okay. Maybe not necessarily per neighborhood, but certainly within the city itself, per capita of the population. All right, so what does that mean? That means that, you know, for every 100,000 or every 1,000, you'd have to break it down into the lowest common denominator. For us, that'd probably be 1,000. Per 1,000 of the citizens, this is what they see,
right?
Right. So I would, within, I would say plus or minus 3%, up or down.
That's close enough.
Yeah. It's certainly in center field. So, so years and years ago, when I was working with another government agency that we're not going to mention. This is my Army days when I was a captain. And I was in counterintelligence. In order to work with this agency, I had to go through some specialized training. And in any event, I had to take several exams. And I had to take and pass, as interestingly enough, two psychological batteries, one at the beginning and one at the end of the assessment period. And it was a full day. It was a full day of assessment batteries, various batteries, IQ tests, and writing exams, and interviews with different individuals. It was a whole series of tests, and because they want to make sure they're getting, you know, the best candidates. And so I went going through this test, and the last, so you have to take, you have to, in order to get in, you have to pass the psych eval, and then you have to pass the psych eval on the way out at the end. So after I did all that and passed, obviously, I asked the doctor administering the exam, does this really weed anybody out? I mean, you know, some of the questions were pretty basic. And he said, oh, yeah, you'll be surprised. So we had this conversation. This started a conversation. Of course, I'm always interested in learning. And he said something that was just really interesting. I'm going to share it with you and the audience. He said that a vast majority of Americans, as I recall, about 70%, suffer from some sort of psychosis. Hmm. Right? They suffer from multiple psychosis or psychoses. And the difference is they've learned how to develop coping mechanisms, or they've learned how to self-medicate or to get by. They've learned how to compensate for that deficiency. And it doesn't inhibit them from being a productive member of society or doing any of that. And I always thought, like, wow, that was like a really high number.
Yeah.
And of course, he said, you, on the other hand, you're fine. We're not seeing anything. That's reassuring, Doc. Thanks. Yeah. But anyway, they're just kidding, folks. But in any event, getting back to my point, is that I think you see a lot of that manifest now in Facebook. I think, you know, of course, you got to remember this is in the 90s, in the early 90s, and, you know, things like Facebook and Twitter and on Instagram and all that stuff wasn't out. And now we have Facebook, and now you have, you know, these people thinking that the COVID-19 shot is going to turn you into a zombie. You know, there are people that actually believe that, or that the government is putting microchips in the serum to give you so they can track you. You know, it's just really crazy stuff. Really crazy stuff. And I can't begin to tell you the number of really bizarre conversations that I've had with people over the years about the government and what they think they're capable of, and you know, what they think that, well, I should say, what, you know, what they believe their capacity is. It's not what they're capable of, but what their capacity is. And I remember one, and along these same lines, you know, there was some concern about years and years ago about monitoring telecommunications. And there's a conversation with something like, oh my God, they can listen in all our cell phone conversations. Blah, 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 blah. And just think about that for a moment. First of all, I doubt we have that capability, but let's assume that we do. Okay, for the sake of argument.
I've heard it alleged that we do.
Okay.
I don't know
how voluminous do you think the amount of that data is that you're collecting?
And that's the thing that makes me kind of wonder, because you'd think that many people would require tens of thousands, if not more, of people. Right.
To analyze.
And you never met anybody who ever did this, did you?
You remember, I come from the intelligence community. I spent a lot of my time in the military and the intelligence community, floating back and forth between the infantry and the intelligence community. Which for me is how I manage to keep my sanity. And and so no matter what you do in the Army and in military intelligence in the Army, all officers are trained analysts. That becomes your first specialty, and then you branch off from there. So I was a tactical intelligence analyst, ran actually fairly large analytical efforts to do different types of things throughout the course of my military career. So I'm familiar with having to collect data, right, and then analyze that data and to draw conclusions from it. And the number of analysts that you would need to sift through this data if you were indeed collecting that much data, even if you were aided by computers that were doing word searches. Remember, computers are, you know, they're only as good as the programming.
Right.
So you might put in keywords, you're still going to get, look, there's over 300 million Americans, right? You know, so just think about all of the data you're taking in. We don't have the capacity to do what is being suggested. So getting back to the psychosis piece and you know, stuff that you trip across on Facebook and you wonder, wow, who ties your shoes? So I don't doubt that number anymore, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Like, wow. I just don't think that, sure, I think the governments are capable of all sorts of things, but it really boils down to capacity. What is the capacity? Do we have that capacity? And, you know, the number of humans that you would need to do something like this would be phenomenal. The effort would be incredible. You know, it's funny, I remember having a discussion a long time ago where a friend of mine, a really bright guy, and he's probably listening to this, so I'm not going to use his name, but a really bright guy, and he says to me, he was really worried about, somebody had spun him up and said, this is back, you know, 10 or 12 years ago, where he was afraid that the government was going to come after his guns. And the government was going to employ the U.S. Army to take his guns, right? And I go, what? What? I said, never happened. And he said, what do you mean never happened? And I said, we don't have the personnel for that. So first of all, that's a crazy thought. Get it out of your head right away. Aside from it being unconstitutional and everything else, it's just a crazy thought. You know, you got all sorts of laws, posse comitatus, that prevent that and so forth and so on. I said, but even if all of those laws were to be changed, all of those laws would be, you know, struck down or changed, whatever the case may be, you just don't have the personnel, right? And he said, you mean to tell me that we can't use the U.S. Army and go from city to city and take everybody's guns? No.
What would you do with them? You got to store them. You got to guard.
Yeah. Well, I said. Them. Well, I said. Listen. I said. Let me. And of course, this is after my second tour in Iraq. I said, look, we had 2/3 of the entire U.S. Army in Baghdad at one time, and we couldn't disarm that city in 10 years. What makes you think we could do it in New York or even Wolfboro? Yeah. I said, come on, that's a crazy. I said, how big do you think the U.S. Army is? I said, you're maybe. Maybe with everybody, doctors, nurses, lawyers, clerks, logisticians, fuel handlers, dog keepers, maybe 1.5 million. How big is New York City?
8 million.
You got to go door to door. I said, that's taking, that's every general all the way down to the lowest private. Right? You're going to do that? Really? The whole U.S. Army? Really? I said, stop it. These are crazy thoughts. So this gets back to, you know, some people, they hear something that sounds specious. And, that's what the government's going to do. That's what exactly they're going to do. And when you start blowing off the dust, and you start digging down and looking at the logistics behind this. And what did Napoleon say about logistics? This is a test question now. It's on your exam.
I failed.
I'm going to have to remind you again. Yes. We've spoken about this. Napoleon said, amateurs talk strategy and tactics. Professionals talk logistics. How do you do it? What's the mechanics behind it? I run into this all the time, especially in government. I run into these, what I call the good idea fairies. Right. This is the individual who's been blessed by the good idea fairy, you know, usually at night when they're deep asleep. And the good idea fairy comes along and she's carrying her duffel bag full of goof up dust. And she anoints one on the head with her good idea wand. Whappa! Whappa! and then she sprinkles the good idea, dust all over the person from liberally from her duffel bag full of goof up dust. And this person says, "Hey, I got a good idea. I was thinking last night. I have a good idea." And the good idea is just that. It's the tactics or the strategy, but they don't think about the mechanics behind it. How are you going to make it work? How are you going to make it so? In other words, the second and third order effects of putting that good idea into practice, right? You're not doing the deep, as I like to call, the deep dive, right? Let's look at the deep dive into something like this, and let's see if it's very practical. And, you know, I had a friend of mine, I'm not going to mention the topic, I'm going to talk around the topic, and I had a friend of mine call me, and he said, "Hey, Dean, we're thinking about doing this." And I said, "Okay." And he says, "What are your thoughts?" I said, "Well, I'm not interested in doing that." He said, "How come?" And I said, "Well, because I already have a guy that does that function, but you want to do this for, you know, a large segment of the county. And in order to do that, you're going to need more than just one individual to put on the payroll to do that. You're going to need like four or five." And so we talked about his plan. I said, "I wouldn't take that forward because this isn't well thought out." And that happens to be the lesson here. These ideas oftentimes are just that. Somebody's blessed by the good idea fairy, and it seems like it's a good idea, right? In other words, it's specious, right? Seems like it's a good idea. But when you start blowing away the dust off the lid of the book and you open it up and you figure out what's required to make it work, it becomes something that is impractical. And we do that a lot in government. And I'm one of these guys that wants to put the brakes on things and says, "Hey, you're not thinking about this logically. You're not thinking about it in steps," right? Second test question, how do you eat an elephant?
One bite at a time.
There you go. So you were paying attention. One bite at a time. That's right. So what you want to do is when you have these good ideas, you want to do the deep dive and you say, okay, how do we make this thing work? And what do we have to do to make it work? And that's called eating the elephant, right? You're going to eat it one bite at a time. And then you're going to put it in you're going to figure it out how you're going to make something work, and then you're going to put it into practice. This is the reason I was an operations officer in the Army, right? We had to come up with some big plans to do big things. And how do you do that? Well, you break it down and you figure it out, and sometimes you got to go back to the powers that be at the Pentagon or whatever, in my case the Pentagon, but you go, or the National Command Authority, and say, "Can't be done. You know, you didn't think this one through clear enough."
Okay. It's 12:25 here on WASR. Of course, it's Police Chief and local resident Dean Rondo. Thank you very much again for hanging out.
Oh, my pleasure.
With us today. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about was, and I, it's not about defund the police. But it was...
Yeah, that's not working well.
No, I know that. I know you've talked about that before. But one of the things that sprang from it is I was listening to a podcast this weekend, kind of got my attention, and that was the deployment of generally unarmed, trained mental health specialists to respond to some calls for service that ordinarily the police would. And I was curious what your thought was on that.
So, I think this falls in a good idea category. It sounds like a really good idea. It sounds very humane. I think you're going to need a lot of them, and I don't think it's going to be as effective as they think it's going to be.
For what reason?
I think they're going to find that a lot of the issues and crises that they're talking about are going to require police presence to begin with, number one. And number two, the person having the crisis probably could benefit from the intervention of a trained mental health clinician early on, the sooner the better, obviously. But having the clinician do that unprotected, I think, is a recipe for disaster.
Okay.
That's why.
The reason I mention it is it seems like a very good idea.
Wow. Yeah.
They could always call for a police presence if they needed one.
That might be too late.
Yeah.
Look, if someone is calling the police because someone's having a bad day, the police got to be there. It's already gotten past the point where the clinician should have stepped in probably 6 or 9 months earlier.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. I've been watching a little bit of Cops now that it's back on TV. I guess it's been canceled long enough. And it's back on.
People want to see the dysfunction in society.
I think they do. And some of the... what I love the fact is they're lying their heads off, yet you know they're on tape, and it's like a road accident. You can't not watch it, but that's just me. But I'm curious about how sometimes a police officer gets a personal satisfaction from his or her job. Are there some times when you go, you know what? I was going to be lenient, but you're being a dick. So let's step this up a notch.
And are you asking me if that happens?
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. Oh, sure it does. Yeah, people are human. Police are human, just like everybody else.
Yeah, it's...
Yeah. You don't, when you're in a position like that, clearly well, here's my personal opinion anyway. It's clearly always in your best, now I have many buddies who are attorneys, and if they heard me speaking like this, their heads would be rolling. They'd be an unguided scud launch. But I'm going to say, I think it's always in the individual's best interest to cooperate and speak with the police. Now, my best friend from college, Bob Forster, who's an attorney, in fact, he's an Air Force attorney, right now, he's down at Maxwell Air Force Base. He said, never, never, never. And he used to be an NYPD cop, too. Never talk to the cops. Never talk to the police. That's what he would say if my buddy were here. He would say, don't ever talk to the cops. I would say, no, I think you can cut off a lot of, you can cut out the middleman really quickly if you cooperate with the police. And when you do that, you don't want to be argumentative. You want to be, disarming. You want to be, as informative as possible, as nice as you can be. So case in point, a buddy of mine, Army buddy of mine, we were both in counterintelligence together in Panama back in the 90s. He's an attorney now, and he was in an argument with his girlfriend, and she had called the police, and she had lied about him. So they end up doing a car stop, felony level car stop on this guy. He was convinced he was going to get shot and killed. And he was as nice as pie with these police officers and very calmly explained the situation and kept his hands where everybody could see them and so forth and so on. And he was armed. My buddy was armed. And the whole thing worked to his advantage. And that's my point. My point is that, cooperating with the police is the fastest way to de-escalate, a bad situation that you may find yourself in. I can't begin to tell you how many cases I've investigated over the years where the people were open, honest, upfront, I was able to open and shut the complaint with no crime. Very quickly. So, and I'll tell you, if I can solve a case quickly, that I'm all on board with that.
How do you deal? Let me put it another way. When you talk to people in your job, an awful lot of people aren't telling you the real story.
Yeah, that's correct.
Either it's half of a story or it's completely made up entirely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I've been wondering how that takes a toll on somebody.
Well, you know, again, that's a great question. We're all human, right?
Right.
And the men and women that work the street, you know, what's going to happen? It's like anything else, just as you can imagine. I was fortunate when I came into this job. I think it was 31 years old or 32 years old. So I was already a little long in the tooth, so to speak, and had some real life experiences. But a young man or woman coming into this job at 21, 22, you know, they're bright eyed and bushy-tailed, and you know, they believe in the best of their fellow man. Of course, you know, I already when I came in there, I already knew better, and it doesn't take long for them to become jaded, and then after a 30 or 40 year career, you can imagine what happens. You know, they become very sour on humanity, and I think that unfortunately is what leads in this profession to an awful lot of suicide and alcoholism and drug abuse and everything else. It's very common in this profession. The thing to keep in mind is that, you know, we're typically working with the bottom 1 or 2% of the population 90% of the time. Clearly, there are always good people that we deal with every day. You know, wonderful to be around. It's great to help them. It could be something as simple as asking for directions or keeping them safe from harm, and those are the high points of the shift or of the week or whatever the case may be. But a vast majority of the people we deal with are, you know, recidivists, right? And they're the 90% of the people that we spend 90% of our time with. But it does take a toll, and it does take a, because we're all human, and it's easy to fall into that mind trap that, oh my God, we're doomed as a society. And what I have to tell my young officers when I can see the depression setting in. You can see it, right? And especially right after about the 5 to 7 year mark is when you first see it, and you have to take them aside and say, listen, son, you know, remember that you're not dealing with 100% of the population. You're dealing with the bottom, you know, 1%. You're dealing with these people 90% of the time. You're not seeing the other 99% of the population that's really, really good, and then that usually picks them right up.
Now, this is a relatively small town.
Yep.
Do you know most people that you deal with professionally?
Oh yes, we do. Oh yes, we do.
Does that change anything?
Well, it makes my job easier.
In what way?
So, you know, police will, if they're paying attention, police officers, investigators will, you know, when they see a crime and they investigate a crime and take it to its conclusion, they're dealing with, you know, things like modus operandi, right? How did the perpetrator do this? Or what's, you know, so you learn patterns, you learn behavior, you learn methods and techniques. And you can, when you see something, you can kind of, okay, I think I know who did this, or I think I know who did that based off of the modus operandi, right? Their method of operation. And so every once in a while, we'll bump into, you know, a really crafty individual, but not often.
Hmm. I just didn't know if it would be awkward with, you know, somebody you know, say at a traffic stop situation or something.
Well, when you say somebody you know, like, are you saying, like, do you know them because they're a recidivist or because they're a family member?
Well,
or a friend?
It could be a friend, yeah.
So, no. So I misunderstood the question. So going back, no, every once in a while, you'll stop somebody that you know in a traffic stop or whatever, but relative to your question, to my or my response to what I thought your question was, we're lucky in the fact that a lot of the people that perpetrate crimes in Wolfboro, these are real crimes, genuine crimes, theft, robbery, that kind of stuff, are known to us. They're recidivists. They fall in that recidivism category. Repeat offenders.
By the way, I wanted to pass on my congratulations. I didn't get the officer's name, unfortunately. I had received a text, and I had been waiting for it. I was driving, so I pulled over, put my hazards on, and I was reading my text. And next thing you know, a police officer came up behind me. I was like, "You okay?" I said, "Yeah, I'm fine. I'm just reading a text. I had it, you know." Mm-hmm. And he said, "Oh, okay. Thank you for pulling over." And then he left.
Yeah.
But it was nice of him to stop and check this.
The audacity of that individual.
Yeah.
What's his name? I'll make sure he never does that again. No, that's exactly what we want them to do.
I didn't get the officer's name, and I should have.
That's community caretaking. That's exactly what we do. We want to make sure everything's okay. He saw your hazards on. He assumed the worst, as they often will, and was probably delighted that everything was in order.
Right. Well, I felt it was important to
And you did everything right. You did everything right by the law. Right, get off the road, take your foot off the brake, put your car in park, you put your hazards on, you went one step further, and you're doing it safely.
Okay. But how do you deal with, how does that set in? You'd mentioned the depression sets in the 5 to 7 year mark. I mean, I'm not a police officer. I don't know anything about being one. But it seems that would leave an awful lot of rhyme ice on the radio tower of your existence.
Oh, it does. It does. It's just like being a social worker, right? I think if you look at social workers, they get into this line of work because they truly care about their fellow human beings. And I've known many, 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 many social workers. Went to college. met them through my wife, who was a nurse, but they all went to college. A lot of them went to college with my wife, personal friends of mine. And like anything else, that takes a toll. And they get into this line of work because they truly care about humanity. And then 5 years into this, they're the most jaded individuals you ever want to meet. Mm. And it does. It really does beat up on the psyche. It does. It beats up on the psyche. Sometimes just something as simple as having a good talk with a supervisor, somebody who's been doing the job for a while, a little bit long in the tooth, can put it in perspective, and it can help them really deal and rationalize that, oh yeah, right, I'm only dealing with the bottom 1% of the population. I'm not seeing that other 99%.
So it's more of a thing you kind of have to confront and then just fight your way through.
That's exactly what you have to do. You got to confront it. You got to deal with it. Like everything else, how do you solve problems? Well, you solve them logically, right? This is nothing more than another problem. I mean, you're gonna approach it, from a logical standpoint, and you got to bring to their attention, hey, you're dealing with the same bad actors every day, And I remember back in the day when I was working the road, it was not uncommon for me to arrest the same individual 3 to 4 times a week.
What were they doing out?
Everyone's entitled to bail.
Well, I understand that, but if you've been arrested 3 or 4 times in a week, something tells me that
you're innocent until proven guilty. You're innocent until proven guilty.
True.
There you'll have some defense counsel saying, well, just because he was arrested 3 times in 1 week by Officer Rondo doesn't mean that he was guilty, Your Honor.
Maybe, but you have to wonder if maybe he shouldn't be committing any more crimes for a while.
Now you begin to see what some of the larger issues are. This fellow that was in Wisconsin, I believe, that drove in and killed, I think now 6 people and wounded or injured up to 60, I think, I last headline
it was
I saw.
A bunch, yeah.
That fellow has a rap sheet like a New York City phone book and was just let out by a judge. Released on bail by a judge, and was actually fleeing from a domestic violence situation when he took the turn down that road and drove over the dancing grannies or singing grannies, as I think they were known as, and then plowed into the other people.
Yeah, I mean, I hope they put him away for a very long time.
Well, there's clearly, that's what I would call, he is a career criminal, right? So this is the case in point. This is the recidivist. This is the person that I'm speaking of when I talk about recidivism. This is the classic recidivist, right? He can't get it right. And when you look at the tenets of the criminal justice system, and now specifically I want to talk about, the tenets of the correctional system,
mm-hmm.
Right? He was a candidate for for long-term incarceration probably 10 years ago, and he should have gone there. And you got to think about this. If the system were working correctly, at least in Wisconsin, because clearly it's not, then six grandmas would still be alive, or five grandmas and one you know, six-year-old boy would still be alive, and all those other 60-some-odd people would still be uninjured, right? Because he would have been incarcerated, he would have been incapacitated, and that's the purpose. That's one of the purposes of the corrections system is what is called incapacitation from society, right? Where you take the society, that the courts, the judicial system has determined that person A is so, they're so reprehensible, they're so out of control, they're so bad, they're such a bad actor, that they have to be incapacitated from society, and they have to be put in this special place we call a prison, where they can't harm or hurt anyone else. And that should have happened. And it didn't happen. And it's not happening all over this country. And we want to be a kinder, gentler country, right? And I think it was Bob Dylan said that, right? We have a kinder, gentler machine gun hand. Wasn't that a song by Bob Dylan? When we live in a free and open society like the United States, a representative republic, we give the citizen an awful lot of freedom. You know, regardless of how you feel about this country right now, individually, you and I and everybody else, we have an incredible amount of freedom that people across this globe do not get to practice. They just do not get to practice. We have unparalleled freedoms in this country. And with that comes this awesome responsibility to be of good behavior. And sadly, a lot of us are not doing that.
Do you think it's time? I know our state senator from Wolfboro is pushing very hard on a bail reform bill. Does bail need to be changed here in New Hampshire?
Yeah, it needs to go the opposite direction, right? We need to get back to when person A breaks a law, it's person A's fault. It's not society's fault that law was broken. It was person A's fault. And person A needs to be held accountable. And they need to be held accountable to the law. And sure, there are facts and circumstances that may mitigate the bad act, and all that deserves to be heard in front of a judge, and in some cases, a judge and jury. But at the end of the day, we need to take a close look at how we're enforcing laws. And I don't mean, I think the police are making all of the right arrests. Don't get me wrong. I think the police are doing a good job. I think we have, in many respects, the courts are hamstrung with laws that are written by men that are inherently flawed and that favor the offender. And I think we need to strike a balance. I think the pendulum has swung too far to the left, and it needs to come back, and it needs to rest somewhere left or right of center a few degrees, but it needs to come back in the middle. Right now it's too far left. That's my opinion. My opinion is that we're not holding people accountable as we should.
Is bail a privilege or a right?
That is a right. Everybody has a right to be bailed.
Okay.
Let me rephrase that. Everybody has a right to go. Everybody's entitled to a bail hearing in front of a judge. You're not entitled to be released, but you're entitled to have a bail hearing.
Okay.
That is a right. That's a right guaranteed by the Constitution, by the U.S. Constitution. You can find that within the body of the Constitution, Article 3, I believe, of the U.S. Constitution, and that's where you're going to find habeas corpus and everything else. I think in the New Hampshire it's in the New Hampshire Constitution. It might be the third paragraph.
Okay. Let's try it another way. There are always going to be people who are in jail for no other reason than they're broke. They can't bail out, you know, for $200 or
I don't believe that.
You don't believe that at all?
I don't. I do not believe that.
Okay.
I don't believe that. I haven't seen anything. We don't put people in prison because they're paupers. All right, we don't have paupers prison.
Well, no, I understand that, but they can't bail out if they're there for a relatively minor or nonviolent offense, and then they can't afford to bond out.
Well, they can afford to bond out because they can go get a bail bondsman, and they can have a bail bondsman post bail. Now, the issue becomes if a bail bondsman is unwilling to post bail because they're a poor risk, and they keep missing court dates, well, sure, that's a problem, but that's not society's problem.
Right.
That is their problem, and perhaps they need to start thinking about their personal choices. Am I making myself clear?
Yeah.
So let me back up the boat here for a second, right, so just so we're all on the same page, right? So if Dean Rondo gets into a motor vehicle crash down in Manchester, and I'm found at fault, and I'm arrested, and they take me to jail, and I don't have any money on me, all right, and I'm a first-time offender, there's a bail bond, and I have a job and everything else. A bail bondsman is going to post bond, and, you know, whatever my, let's say my bond is $500 or $5,000, whatever, and I may have to pay for that. That's a service I'm going to have to pay for, right? And so I'm going to have to owe him some money, but he post my bond, right? Now I'm out on bail, okay? And as long as I comply with the conditions of that bail, okay, and I show up in court and make all the obligatory hearings, and I pay the bail bondsman for his service, whether it's $25 or $50 or $100 for that service, whatever the case may be, then I'm in good standing in the eyes of the law, and then my case is heard, and I'm found not guilty, and life gets back to normal. Now, if person B is a recidivist, and they're constantly skipping on bail, and they're not showing up at court dates, the judge is going to issue a bench warrant for their arrest for $200 cash or $300 cash, $400 cash. The fact that nobody is going to post their bail or post bond for them because they're a bad risk, well, I don't see that as the same thing you're saying. Is it technically true that that person can't get out because they can't post $300 or $400 worth of bond? Sure.
Well, if they're a recidivist, they shouldn't be.
Well, that's my point. And so does that happen? Sure, it happens. But is that society's fault? No, it's not. It's the individual's fault because they kept missing court dates. They kept breaking the law. They kept getting arrested. And they kept missing court dates. And when you miss a court date, the judge gets mad.
Well, I can't blame them.
Don't miss court dates. Go to court. If you've been given a court date, go to court. Right? Don't have the judge have to issue a bench warrant. Right?
I guess maybe I didn't explain it clearly enough. Somebody like me who's never been arrested, I don't know, whatever.
Sure.
You know, I forgot to pay a ticket, whatever, and I find out, you know, oh, there's a warrant. Okay. I don't have any cash on me.
You're entitled to bail. You're going to get
right.
out. You're entitled to bail. You're going to get out. Even if you have no money, you're going to get out. Everyone's entitled to bail.
Now, what's the difference between a bail bondsman and a bail commissioner?
So a commissioner is going to show up. So a commissioner is essentially a part-time position through the courts, is a court officer. He or she is a court officer. And they are going to, for a small fee, $45 I think it is, it might be a little bit more, that they're going to release you on personal recognizance bail, or they're going to let you go on some minor amount of a bond, and you're with conditions, and you're going to theoretically comply with those conditions, or be found in violation of bail, and then that's a arrestable offense. A bail bondsman would be, you know, somebody like me, you know, Dean Rondeau Screen Door Company and Bail Bondsman's company is going to post bail for you for a fee that's going to, and I'm going to assure to the judge that you're gonna appear at court, and if you fail to appear at court, I'm theoretically going to hire a bounty hunter and come get you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what a kind of what a bail bondsman does.
I've never seen a storefront here in New Hampshire.
Oh, yeah, we have them.
Do we?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we figure we must have them.
It's yeah. Just, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, I never hear any advertising
usually,
on radio or television.
Usually when the judge says, hey, you got to post, you know, $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 worth of bond to get out, you're going to contact one. Because I suppose you could have, if you could come up with that kind of cash, you could have a bail commissioner, you know, you could give the bail commissioner $20,000 and he's going to let you go and he's going to turn that money into the court. And it's going to be held in escrow and make sure you comply. But what a bail bondsman does is he basically is issuing a promissory note to the court. If you don't appear, he's out that money.
Okay.
Until he produces your body. Hence the term bounty hunter.
Oh, okay. So who gets the money back when you show up?
Well, therein lies a really good question. Sometimes the bail bondsman, sometimes the money doesn't come back. Sometimes the courts keep it.
Really?
Yeah.
Why would they do that?
Because they're pissed.
Oh.
You didn't show up.
So they revoke the bail?
They revoke the bail. That's exactly what happens.
And then they keep the money?
They keep the money, yeah.
Even though you showed up?
Oh, no, okay. Well, we'll back up.
Oh, okay.
If you showed up, no, you're fine.
You
eventually get the money. So if you comply with all your conditions, and eventually, even if you're found guilty, you get the money back. Some of that money may go to pay fines and so forth if it's in the court's possession. But if you're constantly skipping on bail and that bounty hunter has to come get you or you get arrested in a traffic stop, yeah, you can kiss that money goodbye. The courts are keeping that.
Hmm.
Did that make sense?
It makes sense now.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
All right, misunderstood.
So then the next time this person got arrested, they probably wouldn't qualify for bail at all.
Well, no. The judge is still going to listen to that bail hearing, and then somebody like me is going to say, hey, Your Honor, you know, they shouldn't be let out on bail. Every time you let them out on bail, bad things happen. The judge is really probably going to let them out on bail.
Is it a frustrating part of the job to arrest someone knowing that you're going to see them again the next night?
No, it's not frustrating. I don't think it's frustrating. I think it's unfortunate that sometimes the courts don't take our recommendations as seriously as they should. But at the end of the day, it's the way the system works. Here's what I think about the system. Is the system inherently flawed? Yes, it is. Does the system have issues and problems? Yes. Could it be better? Yes. Is it the best system I've ever seen? Yes.
Absolutely. So it's the worst possible system except for all the other ones?
I wouldn't say it's the worst possible system. I would say our system works pretty damn good. But like everything else, nothing is ever 100%, right? Nothing is as ever good as you want it to be. But I will tell you right now, and I've seen a lot of systems in this world, and ours is the very best. You know, last night as I was getting ready to go to bed and just entertaining myself, I got to share this with you that I was and having served and well not served but trained overseas and trained did a lot of training in Germany over the years in the military. I know this for a fact. I was watching. A YouTube video of how some of the European countries, Poland, Russia, the Ukraine, Germany, enforced the mask mandates. and his various and you can go Google this. It's funny. And of course, they have the same issues that we do, right? They have, you know, young people, and some of these young people don't want to wear masks, and they have, you know, police officers in the malls, and the police officers are wearing their masks, and they see somebody walking in the mall without a mask on. Out comes the nightstick, and they get three beatings with the nightstick until the mask comes on.
All right.
And then everybody else magically puts their mask on who's watching this. You know, in Russia, you jaywalk and a cop sees you. Out comes the nightstick. He's going to grab you by the neck, by the nape of the neck, and he's going to, as hard as he can, he's going to beat your legs with that nightstick. In Germany, right, democratic Germany, right? Germany is a constitutional republic, right?
Yes, it is.
So in Germany, you know why the Germans are like the most law-abiding people I've ever seen, okay? I've seen this oh so many times. Usually it's a drunk American at a beer house. Will mouth off to a German officer, and the next thing it's like the fastest I've ever seen. That nightstick comes out and cracked across the skull, and that person has gone down. Okay, there's zero tolerance for that type of behavior, and. In the United States, we're not like, and I'm not suggesting for one moment that we be like that. That's not what I'm suggesting. I'm just saying that, you know, the laws in different countries are very different. And when, you know, because we live in this, you know, we're 3,000 miles from Europe, you know, we're, you know, across the Atlantic, we're somewhat isolated, right? In all these European countries, principally operate the same way, and there's very little tolerance for what we put up with here, and it's so again, when I go back to, we have a lot of freedoms, we have a lot of freedoms, even though people feel as though we don't.
I see what you're saying, and I think I agree with you. Unfortunately, we are running out of time. So I would thank you once again. It's nice to see you after a couple of weeks off.
Oh, yes, I know. Thank you very much.
And I'm glad your holiday went well.
Everything went well, yeah.
Good. All right.
Yeah, thank you. And all my best to you and your family.
Next week in this spot, we're going to have to preempt you, actually. We have a lady from Cornerstone VNA coming in about flu vaccines and COVID-19 vaccines. And we'll be talking about that then.
Oh, good. Okay, so, sounds good.
All right, 1 o'clock, news is next.